What's up? I'm Chris Cox, host of the Wild Ones podcast, where we work in our love daily. And we are all about sharing and giving flowers to those who work in the community, whether it be a community organizer, whether you're a head of a nonprofit, or whether you're just someone who wants to volunteer time. We want to give you your flowers now and give you the space to tell your story. And we have a very, very amazing, awesome guest. Our first in-studio guest, as everybody is seeing it. So our first in-studio guest here for the Wild Ones podcast. I want to welcome to the show Cammie Watkins of Inclusive Communities in Omaha.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here and to chat with you today.
Yes, it's awesome. So Cammie, what I wanted to do, I know I mentioned you work for Inclusive Communities in Omaha, but I would like if you could tell your story a little bit about yourself and how you got into this chair right now.
Yeah, absolutely. So I always like to start out by telling folks that I am a 2.5 generation Omahan. So born and raised in Omaha. My mom was born and raised in Omaha, and my grandma moved here when she was 15 from Alma, Arkansas. Alma, Arkansas. I always say it wrong because I'm not from the South. Grew up in the Midwest, and I intentionally like folks to know that I am a Nebraska native, because every time I go anywhere, you know, if you're on the East Coast or the West Coast, they're always like, Black people live in Nebraska? Yes. And they're like, and it's more than just me and my family. And then even with coming to Lexington, when I got into the hotel, a woman says to me, oh, are you from Chicago? And I said, no, Omaha. And she's like, oh, you just have that air about you. And I was like, I'm not going to address that today. I'm going to just go ahead and park and go to bed. But I, having grown up and being born and raised here, my mom being from here, my dad was actually from Chicago. Met my mom when he decided to join the Air Force and was stationed at the Offutt Air Force Base because he was just starting. They met at a military dance and he fell in love. She fell in love. And then they got married and moved. He got stationed in Oxford, England. So my brother was actually, my older brother is 12 months and 18 days older than me. So we're basically Irish twins. And he was born in Oxford, England. And I always point this out because then my mother got pregnant with me, but decided she couldn't, it would be too hard to basically be raising two babies in England, even for the short time before my dad was almost out. So she moved back to Omaha where I was born. So I'm mad about it still today because I could be a dual citizen, but her selfishness of wanting to be cared for with her family.
Jeez, mom.
I know.
Get it together.
Did you think about me in these moments? But fine, I support that. I love those things. So I was born in Omaha, and then they moved to San Antonio because my dad got stationed to Lackland Air Force Base. We were down there for a while. And then my parents decided to get divorced. And so she moved back to Omaha. So basically, it's when I was 8 years old. So while this was like home, and I definitely consider Omaha home, I was a little bit of a stranger here, but I always give that backstory because growing up in San Antonio, the neighborhood, the little circle that we were in on near the base, there's just so much like Latinos there. So I always, as well as like white folks and then Black families. So I never really grew up in spaces where I was only surrounded by just one race or identity. And so that has always just been the norm for me. It's just that there's different people with different spaces. I remember sitting at one of our neighbors' houses and the mothers and the grandmothers and aunts were making tamales. And so I remember seeing them just like husking the corn and getting the corn ready for it. And that's just, those memories are so vibrant for me. And then like the Corey and his sister, who are our babysitters, had a pool and that was a white family. And so I remember being at their house. So this sense of kind of belonging and inclusion has just always been a part of my life. And so fast forward, we moved back to Omaha. Now my mom is a single mother. The experience is kind of navigating poverty. She's always worked in the U.S. Attorney's office. So she was a legal secretary. So there was this kind of weird dichotomy of we were in the public housing, grew up in public housing. And it was always in like a duplex or a house, never in the projects. But I always said to folks that I was always a couple blocks away from the projects, literally and metaphorically, as I grew up. But because my mother worked at the U.S. Attorney's office, we had access to wealth and experiences that I wouldn't have had she not had that job. So we had chances to go to theater. We did community service. I remember there's the corporate cup run, which was always raising money for various charities around community. And service was such a huge part of my mother's life and my dad's life. And then I later learned when I took an identity journey that service, love, and community or family are the three values that really carry my family. So as much as I like to think, oh, well, I am just different and this is who I am, I'm actually sitting on the shoulders of a legacy of a family that this was always part of who we are. So it's ingrained in my ancestry. So when I think about what got me to doing the work that I'm doing today, it's been kind of my ancestors and the legacy that's been passed down to me from my entire family, that it was never by accident that this sense of love is what guides us, and community or service in faith for a lot of folks, even though while I don't prescribe to any specific faith, I do understand that there are things that are above and beyond us. So our universe and the spirits, spirituality of nature and things are what is what I should be responsible for and what I need to be caring for, both whether it be through nature or humanity of people. So in college, I went to school on a vocal performance scholarship. I thought I wanted to be an arts administrator. I thought I wanted to be a therapist. So I studied, my major was psychology. My minor was music. I only switched to my minor in music after I took musical theory and was like, this sucks. I do not like music theory. This is hard. I just want to sing. So I made it my minor because then I didn't have to take any more music theory classes. But I think I really came into knowing, getting closer to who I am, because growing up in Omaha public schools, then there were very few Black students that were in honors classes. So we were always kind of just looked at. I was called a schoolie, an Oreo, which was like Black on the outside, white on the inside because of the way I talk. I loved education. I loved school. I was a high achiever. And so I tried to always separate my Blackness and assimilate into the wider cultures to make sure that people just saw me as me, because I was afraid if they kept seeing me as Black, they would assume all the narrative stereotypes that we saw in the 80s and 90s of latchkey kids that were growing up lower income, growing up in single mother households. There were all of these statistics that they would actually teach us in school that mirrored the life that I was living. But I was like, that's not who I am. So I figured, and I addressed a lot of that to being Black. And so I always felt like, okay, if I can just get them to maybe not see that I'm Black and then give me a chance to see me, we'll be okay. And it wasn't till college that I started seeing that we are a diaspora of the African-American Black culture. There is not just one way to be Black. And so I don't have to be afraid to be seen for that, like, because I do it, it's something that Black people do. And so having that, meeting Black women and men from California and Chicago and the South, like Texas and all of these spaces, and just seeing them be their full selves, I started to step into my own self and have a little more confidence. I came back to Omaha. My decision was that I wanted to work in nonprofit. So my entire adult career, I've only ever worked in nonprofit organizations, starting with Head Start. And that was fully in. What's interesting is that every job and role that I've had, it was by accident. I somehow ended up there. My mother, when I moved back after graduating from college, I asked my mom to go to the Boys and Girls Club to pick up an application for me, because this was like in 2002. Which feels like it's not that long ago, but that was a really long time ago. I'm like, I have to think, Wi-Fi wasn't invented, kids. I'm not that old, but this is just the world that we
went
lived
to in. School at the time where A, we actually had to physically complete an application, physically hand it in. Cell phones, text messages, cell phone screens was only blue.
You weren't using them. I was like, you're not a doctor. What do you have a cell phone for?
You know, we weren't sending pictures. We weren't scanning things with our phone back then. So, it's a different world. So those of you who are younger listening, what do you mean go pick one up? Yes, you had to physically go meet the person you were possibly going to work for.
Mm-hmm.
So they can maybe prejudge you. So you had to look good. Your parent, my mom used to always say, if you're going to go get an application, dress well.
You had to dress up twice. Once for the interview, once to go pick up that application.
And then dress for the job you want, not the job you have.
Yep.
So those are very real sentiments that were given to us to go get a job. So yeah.
100%. And so I sent my mother to go. My mom went to the wrong door. She walked into the door where the Head Start office was and not to the door where the Big Brothers Big Sisters office was, picked up the application. I just filled it out, turned it in. I didn't realize till after, because then I went back into and it said you have to take it back to this main office, which was at 30th and Parker, which if you're familiar with Omaha, that's in the heart of North Omaha. Very close. There is actually a large projects development that used to be right next door to it. It's all torn down now. And now that's the 75 North Highlander redevelopment that they've done. That's mixed use. That's really centered around how do we regain affordable housing, but also rebuild wealth in the economic development in North Omaha. So it was, that's kind of a pivotal area. And it was the Child and Family Development Corps. It was a nonprofit that ran the Head Start program, had been for like maybe 20, 30 years, and it was predominantly BIPOC run. So in Omaha, Nebraska in 2002, for me to found a nonprofit where the executive director and majority of the executive leadership are Black or Latino or Native individuals was huge. And that was my first job out of college. I didn't realize at the time how unique and what a great experience I was about to have walking into a space where I wasn't just one of a few, I was one of the many, and the leadership that I got to see modeled. So where a lot of people talk about representation and how important that was, I had it, and it was all by accident. I never even thought I was applying there. I didn't know I wanted to work there. My mother just walked into the wrong door. And by fate, I got this job. And I was a family advocate, so helping recruit families into the center and working with youth. And that I loved that job. I absolutely loved it. In the time and all of the gifts that I gained from even the turmoil that I experienced there has set me up for how I've moved forward the rest of my life in terms of how I lead and what I look for in a workspace. Because having the first job that I had, loving it, taught me that I spend too much time, we all spend too much time at work to do something that we don't love, that doesn't sit within our passion and our purpose. So the long story short, the nonprofit lost its grant to be able to hold the Head Start program. There were some financial things that occurred. And people were being laid off. There was a lot of turmoil. It was switching over with new management that were the organization that took it over was predominantly white. So then, of course, the culture that had been created was no longer really accepted, where they had, you didn't have to have a college degree to have roles that traditionally would be a college degree. And I started to feel the pain of the majority of people who didn't have all those experiences and the knowledge and the ability to show up in the ways that I had kind of been indoctrinated to do, were losing their jobs. And I just couldn't sit in that any longer. So I left just shy of 2 years. I still would go back in the summers and kind of see people, but I left because I just was, and there was a period of time there that they actually, there are 2 weeks that none of us got paid. So we had worked 2 weeks for free because of just the turmoil that was happening. So seeing that, I think helped me better figure out, okay, this is what needs to happen and what kind of security and supports. And then I was a community organizer for a little bit. Then I got tired of that because I got elevated to where I was overseeing 13 states work around building of energy efficiency and nonprofits through the Sierra Club. But then realized I was too far away from the people and that I missed doing kind of grassroots work, and my work was going to actually take me away from Omaha. So I had a choice to either move to DC or someplace else. And I wasn't ready to leave yet because my family was all here. My grandmother had recently gotten sick, got diagnosed with COPD. And so I didn't want to be far from her. And so I took a job with the Opera and worked there in arts administration for a couple years and hated it because, again, just culture wasn't what I needed it to be in the workspace.
It's like back to that music theory in college. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't like this. This is hard.
And I don't like it.
Like,
and while I love opera,
yes,
I didn't like the culture of the environment. And I was like, nope, we're not going to work in spaces and things that we don't love. So left, went to Habitat for Humanity and was there for a few years, and then kind of got in that stagnated space where people didn't see my brilliance and that recognized that I have the power and need to have the ability to lead through autonomy and do the work that makes a difference for the community. So I, again, by accident, texted Maggie Wood, who is my co-executive director with Inclusive Communities, and said, I texted her and one other person, said, I'm looking for a new job. If you hear of anything in operations or programming, let me know. And she sends me a text back and says, check your email. I just posted a job today. And it was for operations and business development. So both programs and operations for Inclusive Communities. She tells me that there were like 12, several people. And she's at the moment that you sent that app, like, I was like, oh my goodness. And it's like, you still put me through the entire application. She's like, I had to. We have to be fair.
We have to be thorough, uh-huh. but we can't tell you you have the job, but you got the job.
She was like, and the moment you sent that to me, I just like, I thought, and she and I had worked together at Head Start like years before. She was in the operation. So she was the executive director's assistant. That was her first job in nonprofit and my first job ever. And we had crossed paths there, but we didn't really work directly. But she said, I remember seeing you there and thinking, this girl's going to go places. I'm going to keep an eye on her. And so when we had the chance to come back, so I will tell you, like, she has been the greatest champion for me to elevate me and seeing the spaces of, like, just saying, I know what you can do. And so that imposter syndrome that many of us have, she helped pull me out of that and to say, Cammy, like, never apologize for your greatness. Don't be afraid to try things and don't be afraid to just step into and be who you are, because you already have it. You've always had it. And I just needed somebody to help me better recognize where it is. And so the partnership that we've had and the partner she's been as a mentor, first as a supervisor for me and then now as a partner in this work, has been really beautiful and really great. And I'm excited now to have the opportunity to step into this leadership solely and alone, knowing that, like, she's built a foundation to ensure that I'm set up for success, which I don't think happens often for Black female executive directors.
That is your story. That, just listening to that, is amazing and is inspiring. And there's so many, like, gems that you drop. The one I'm gonna backtrack it. The fact that you said when you were working at the opera and you said they didn't recognize my brilliance. I latched on to that right now because most people say, oh, you know what? I didn't feel treated fair, or I didn't feel like I could grow there. But just you had that understanding that, no, I am brilliant. Like, I had this self-awareness, like, no, I'm good at what I do, and you're not recognizing. You didn't downplay yourself. And then the next thing I'll say is when you talked about your first job and you realized, or after you realized that, I love what I do. And we don't have that much time here, so I'm only going to do things that I love, which has helped propel you forward. Because a lot of us, especially within the community of color, we do something because it's going to pay the bills. And we're afraid to take that leap.
Yep.
We're afraid to say, I'm going to do this. I'm going to build a plan first. Don't just take the leap. Build a plan. Make sure it's viable. Make sure it can earn money, or you can do something that's going to, you know, support your livelihood. But we're so afraid to take that leap. And so for you learning that early, taking that leap, and then recognizing yourself and saying, no, I'm brilliant. I'm smart. I know what I'm doing. Yeah. I don't need to be here. Like, this is all cool. Okay, great. Pay the bills. Okay, where's my plan to go? Mm-hmm. Where's the exit plan? And so just talking about that. And I know you've told this story before, but it's the first time I got to hear it. So I loved it all. I'm soaking it all in. And I really, really am excited for the people that will listen to this and be able to hear that too. And so for other little girls out there that are going to hear it and be like, yeah, I'm brilliant too. I don't have to take this. I don't have to just be okay with whatever you decide I should be okay with. I can make my own way.
Yeah. And well, there's so much that we're, and I remember distinctly when I was maybe, it's by my houses because we moved a lot, being in OHA housing, Omaha Housing Authority housing, because my mother would get raises, thank goodness. And I'm reading right now Poverty in America. It's Matthew Desmond's book, and it's the follow-up to his book about eviction. And he just talks about how poverty is created And it doesn't just center on people that are poor being the cause of poverty, but that actually there's systems that intentionally create it. And so my mother working for the U.S. Attorney's Office, so having a good paying job, but having to raise three kids because my little brother was born the year my mom and dad got divorced. So then that added a third child to this already two, and he's 8 years younger than me. So I kind of became mom number two in that, but that she would get a raise each year because it's a government job. They're trying to have people with living wages. We would price out of the home that we were in. So she had to move someplace else so that to be able to continue to afford that, to still be on housing assistance. So the only assistance we really had was housing and then WIC when Timmy was a baby. And so having, I remember, so whenever I think of like my childhood, I think by which house we were in. And so this was probably about third grade that I remember looking in the mirror and there's all these messages that were saying to me, okay, you're not enough. You're not, you're less than. And thinking like, I'm great, but I never would say it to people because I thought, well, then people are going to think that I am arrogant and all of these pieces. So I just would kind of say it to myself, by myself in my room. And I had my own room because I was the only girl, but never out loud. And we, especially as young Black girls or girls of color, we get all these messages that if you can't be too boisterous, you can't be too bold, you can't be too open, you can't be too confident, because then you are bad. And getting to that point, so it took time. It's a journey. So if like young girls that aren't there yet, do not feel bad. The pathway will come, the moments will come, the people will come. And if they don't come, you have to find them and you keep doing the work till you get to that point where you see who you are. And I will tell you, the full journey for me didn't happen till probably I was 35 when I had enough people saw in me and told me like, no, Kimmy, you have a gift and you're special. And my biggest thing is, I was like, there's nothing extraordinary about me. And I like to push that message because I want people who are ordinary to know that we are just ordinary, everyday people. I am average at best. And that doesn't mean that I don't have the ability to do extraordinary things, in recognizing where my strengths lie, where my brilliance lies, and then having the opportunity to work at it, because it's not been easy. But because this is my intention, is to make an impact, to have a purpose. I keep a token. It's what like a little chip from gambling chip, and it has purpose written on it. And that's like my token. And I know that in life, my main value is I have a purpose, and that purpose is to make a difference in whatever way that is. And so I let that guide me into how, even though I might just be ordinary, I can still do extraordinary things that scare the crap out of me, but I do it afraid, and then go from there knowing that I have enough people behind me that support me because I've built a community, and because I want to give back to others, others will pour into me.
That I want to talk about, when you talk about it took you to 35 on your journey to find that, right? And for me, it was the same way, but opposite. Because I grew up in New York City. Mm-hmm. And so I always had the label thrust on me of what I was going to be. Mm-hmm. And then the moment I started getting bigger, it was like, okay, I'm either going to be an athlete or I'm expected to knock everybody out. Mm-hmm. So that's the only way I carried myself as growing up. And I had this huge shell. Like, I didn't like anything I wasn't supposed to like. Like, or I didn't let everybody know that. So I didn't let people know that I liked foreign movies, or I didn't let people know that I liked anime, or I didn't let people know that I liked certain books, or that I liked Greek mythology or things like that. Nope, I'm just a football player and I can defend myself in the streets. That was it. And it honestly took till I was like 35, 36 to like figure out like, and this all started with my podcasting journey and learning podcasting and talking to people. It's like, how come I haven't told anybody that I like these things? Like, I have friends that I've known for years, mm-hmm. and I've never sat down and said, you know, I really like anime. I really like, you know, there's a lot of French movies, or there's a lot of like German, like foreign films. Have you watched this? Or have you watched this? Or have you watched this? Never actually like revealed that or talked, showed that side to people. And it was like a moment. Like, it like almost made me cry a little bit, because I was like, how come I never talked about this? Like, how come I never said anything to this? Yeah. And I was so, it hit me so much, because, and then it made me feel proud though, because I was showing it to my kids though, because that was my safe space. So it was like, okay, I can watch this at home. But then I realized that it's mainstream now, you know, and it is a space for them, and they love it, and they're sharing it with their friends, and they're not hiding it. And it made me feel like, well, if my kids are doing that, I got to do it, you know. But also how it helped me is I saw a gentleman, he's a football player. His name is Mike Daniels, and he played football for the Green Bay Packers and Cincinnati Bengals, and black guy out of New Jersey, you know, went to Iowa for school to play football. So kind of the same path that I was on. I didn't go big time like he did, but I went to Morningside. Shout out Morningside University. So I went to Morningside, you know, but then I happened to see him on social media, and he went to a Comic-Con event, and he was full dressed regalia, and being able to see a black man from the East Coast played football very similar to me, but then feel super confident to go to an event where everybody's going to be watching him outside of the shell of his football uniform, outside of his helmet, outside of his shoulder pads. And he was his self, his true self. And that like hit me in waves. And I was like, well, how come I'm not doing this? How come I didn't tell anybody? How come I haven't talked to anybody about this? I need to switch things up. And I dove into the podcasting, and I was like, I'm going to talk about it. I'm going to talk about all the stuff that I never got to talk about my entire life. And I am not just this one person. And that, and then, and even being able to get to that understanding was getting out of my neighborhood, getting out of New York City and going to the Midwest and going to Iowa and being around different people. And in New York, you're around a melting pot. Yeah. Like, I used to ride a train and could hear people speaking Russian, speaking Patois, like speaking Spanish. Like, you hear that, but everyone has the same shell on. So you're not the same ethnic background, but you all have the same inner city shell. And then when I was able to get out of that and realize that and be around different people, it changed my mindset of I didn't have to be just one thing. And so when you were talking, that's why I was just listening like, oh, I got to ask questions now, because I was just gazing and understanding that, yes, this is such a shared experience that more black people, more Latino people, more Native people are experiencing this. You're not alone. Like, you are awesome and brilliant and amazing, and you can be 92 different things. Just because you're black doesn't mean you have to love this set of things. Yeah. You don't have to do that, and you don't have to overcorrect and go somewhere that's not inner city and feel like you have to be more black than black. Because that is a thing that happens.
That's a false narrative. It's a false story they've told us. My communications manager, Ange, so non-binary, use they, them pronouns, or just Ange. I remember one day they were telling me, we were talking about Lil Nas X, and it's like, can you imagine how much creativity in what so many other kids would do could be like Lil Nas X if your parents just allowed you to be free, or if society just allowed you to be free? Look at the life that he has and the way that he is leaning into his art and all the ways that he does, simply because no one told him he couldn't.
Yeah. And it's accessibility, because now when you wanted to make it as a musician or you wanted to do something in your life, you felt like you couldn't reach it. You couldn't do it. I don't have any, I can't make music. I can't do this. But we just had a conversation about technology, because it went out on us a little bit, but I can make a whole song on my iPad.
Yeah.
You know, and it comes free. GarageBand is free. And you have a lot of these musicians now, especially the younger ones, that was their first introduction into, oh, how do I create music? And it's free. And they were being super creative because they had a limited window to work in. Like, I don't have this. I don't have this, but I have this. So how can I make this program sound awesome? Yeah. And it really sparks off that level of creativity for them. And I mean, it's great to see. And it's great to see in our community. Because even in the 80s, you had Boy George, right?
Yep.
You had Boy George, the same thing. Very similar, the same thing. But again, it was kind of taught of, that's not what you do. Or as Black is, why are you liking that weird music? It's mm-hmm. weird. But now it's just music now.
Yes.
And now you can just be. And Lil Nas X can just be.
And well, like, I remember music. When Darius Rucker came out as a country yeah. singer, and everybody was like, Darius.
Let me do it. And then I was mad because I'm like, y'all didn't listen to him when he was in Hootie and the Blowfish. Now you mad now? Because he's in a country singer? Like, you didn't even
He was an alternative rock before. Like, yeah. We were okay with, okay.
Like, he was touring with Fish and nobody said anything. See, that tells you I've been, like, undercover listening to music for a long time.
Listen, I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska. Yeah. You know I'm over here with Third Eye Blind.
Yes.
And all these things.
Yes, man. Listen, don't. Aerosmith, and that when they hit that run of like late 90s to 2000s,
fire.
You can't say anything. Three Doors Down.
Listen, I secretly had a Garth Brooks CD. And when I talk about secretly, like, because you, again, kids in the past, we had to go and buy CDs.
Actual physical music.
It wasn't a download, and you had to go save some money, go to a store. Purchase CD, could maybe order it online from that CD package. But so I had, you know, everybody was supposed to be listening to Monica and Brandy. They were like, if you're a Black girl, that's the music you was listening to. I caught like Friends in Low Places, and I became a huge fan of Garth Brooks, and I got that Missing Pieces album. And if you were to start to play it right now, I know every single song on there. Baton Rouge, Calling, that was my spot.
Yes.
And I was like, do I like country music now? And I had it hidden in a drawer in my house, and I would just pull it out. Like, even my family, I was a closeted country music fan of Garth Brooks because I thought, you aren't supposed to like this music.
Okay, so you know my secret CD is, because I had a secret CD. My secret CD was Lenny Kravitz 5,
okay.
His album, and I had it in a case with no cover. That's how I hid it. I had it, it was a blue case. You could get blue CD cases mm-hmm. or different color yep. ones. And so I had it in, like, I think it was a blue CD case. I took the cover out of it, and like, I think I threw it away. But I knew that was what it was. And I would listen to that with the skip boost on, so it wouldn't skip because I had to ride the train. And so I would listen to Lenny Kravitz 5, and he had a song on there before Zoe Kravitz became Zoe Kravitz. He had Letters to Zoe, and that was just my favorite song. I would play that thing on repeat, and I used to take the train from the Bronx, from the Brooklyn all the way to Bronx to go to high school, and that's about an hour and a half, two-hour mm-hmm. ride. And sometimes that whole ride was that whole song. But that's cool. As somebody else with a secret CD. But it's cool. It's so great that as an adult now, mm-hmm. we can be in a space where we can share that. We can talk about that shared experience yeah. and then know that other people will understand that. Mm-hmm. And then now it won't be a later in life shared experience for someone else listening to it. Mm-hmm. It'll be, this is just what they do.
Yeah, it's okay. Yes. Love what you love. Feel what you feel. Like, be liberated. And I think I love the liberation movements where folks are talking about, we're not just talking about how do we feel included and belonging. That is important. And it's a yes. And how do we be liberated? How do we just get to be free, to be who we are and comfortable in our own skin, no matter what that looks like, and that there isn't just one way to be a human in this society or in this space and in this world.
And then, so bringing that back to, so now, as we've talked about how you got into space, now you're at Inclusive Communities, the executive director. How are you taking your experience and how are you passing that on or sharing that with the communities and with the organizations that you're working with now?
Yeah. So the vision that I have and that we kind of started as part of the partnership, as I talked about Maggie, my co-executive director, and now my just kind of the guide that led me to this spaces, is that we have to do a holistic approach. Everything in community and space and society is hitched to another. So we're all linked. And so the vision that we have is, how do we just set out a very aspirational goals and then work to achieve them. I did a values fingerprint, where I looked at what are my top three values, and they've changed throughout time. And so purpose, how that's always been kind of guiding me in doing this values fingerprint. My three values in this season of my life are impact is number one, bravery is number two, and abundance is number three. And so whether I know that I live in that value of impact all the time, that's why it easily came up as number one. I was surprised bravery came up to be number two, bravery or courage. But that is what I'm trying to do, is to do the things that I would typically be afraid of. And how do I help society and the community have more courage and bravery to stand up, to speak out, to make change, and then abundance. I have always said that life is not pie, it's a buffet. And if you've been to Old Country Buffet or any kind of other all you can eat, when we run out of something, they come out and fill it. So if we operate in this sense of abundance, where I don't have to be afraid that there's only so many pieces, and start to recognize as a people in a community, and we live as communal beings and collaborative beings, that if we run out together because we're working together, we can replenish. And the more of us that are fed, the more of us are able to feed. So in the work that we're doing at Inclusive Communities, we're moving forward in this next season of our organization under my leadership of three key things that we're trying to address. And it's community building, youth leadership development, and institutional change or transformation. And in doing that, that allows us to touch every part of and aspects of a community in the different ways through policy, through conversation, through education. And so in looking at that, one of our aspirational goals is that Nebraska will have the most inclusive communities in America. So we truly believe that here at the heart of the heartland, that we can spark the flame that burns across the country to truly promote what does inclusion look like around the world. And we have the opportunity to do this here because we have the philanthropic will and agency. And I believe at the heart of all people, all of us have the desire for security and happiness and quality of life for our families. It's about showing that we don't have to be afraid of the other. My vision for this community is that we move past fear, we stop operating in fear, and operate out of a sense of abundance and love. And once we can start to shift that, to stop showing up as people who lead with our fear and instead lead with our love, we can change systems and we can have transformation, and it's going to happen in different ways. And so that's the work that we're trying to do through our different programs, our Omaha Table Talk series, which is now just Table Talk. And we're going to be launching one soon in a smaller city in Nebraska. So not quite ready to announce it, but that's happening. We've been doing it in Omaha. We've been doing it virtual. So it's allowed people across the state to participate. That's our community building program. It's just starting with having difficult conversations over comfort food. Whether that comfort food be from your couch because you're watching on your screen, or you're sitting at the tables with us in person, where you're just interacting with strangers and having the chance to just recognize that each of us has shared common stories, as we've just learned here today. No matter how many coasts or distance separate us, there's so many connectivity moments. Let's build community that way. And that's the start. Then the next step is youth leadership development. It has always been youth that have led the movements that have changed, started to spark change in our country. And so why are we not empowering youth to continue to be the leaders for the future? And I tell you, this Gen Z, our Zoomies, or the little new generation, and then Generation Alpha that's coming after them, we ain't ready for these kids. Like, the power that these youth possess, our camp serves from 14 to 21-year-olds, and they are so brilliant in their creativity and their just ability to connect. All we need to do is just start supporting them in tools and knowledge to let them grow and do it. And so I want to share power as much as possible. Like, I've tried to shift away from this language of empowerment, because empowerment is like, I'm not giving you anything that you didn't already have. So it's about me sharing the power that I have with you. So that piece. And so our InclusCity Camp, which is allowing youth to just come and learn and grow and lean into the power that they always have. And that's something I tell to everyone, is you already have power. We have always held power. it's been shadowed away from us and not allowed us to use it. So how do we start to share that power with the youth? And then lastly, transformational work within institutions. That's the policy work. So I see us getting into being more proactive. I know that there's a lot of stuff that's coming down that's telling people that you don't belong, that you're not worthy, that you, what your life that you live is not right, with the anti-trans legislation, the trying to roll back rights around voting, and or even just kind of not allowing folks which to have driver's licenses and those types, all of those pieces, Native students to just wear their regalia, their hair, the way, and even Black students, the same.
Being able to go be Black adults, being able to go to work, and my hair or your hair not being looked at as that's not professional.
Correct. Like all of those things, like we are now starting in the year of our Lord 2023 to just like change these things that should have been changed centuries or decades ago. I want us to not have to be so reactive to that. There are coordinated efforts around the country to make policies that keep us separated and that keep us down, that we want to work to start to be more proactive about how do we create those coordinated efforts to lift up everyone. And our vision for the organization is we envision a society that of diversity, inclusion, equity, and justice for all people. And I highlight that all part because folks think, well, when you're doing multiculturalism or you're doing diversity, equity, inclusion work, that it's only about marginalized or people with disabilities or people of color. And that's not true. When we talk about society, it's for all. So that means that white folks got to come along on this journey with us. And you aren't left behind because when we lift up the least among us, the kind of Buddhist Gandhi idea of supporting the last child, all of us, all like rising tides lift all ships. So we need, like, I'm looking at a society that's a more better, a beautiful society for everyone. White folks, too, you are part of this society. So you're part of this work along with us.
Yes. And we shouldn't have to drag you along. You should be kicking and screaming. You should just be like, okay,
this is for you too. This is for you. Benefit from this. There's so many books and stories and data. If you're a data person, I can get you the data that says that like we are better off because all of us are here and all of us are cared for.
And some people need the data. Some people need it. But speaking of the kids, though, this new generation, like Z and Alpha, and I don't even know all the names. So I was like, Generation Alpha? What, I didn't
know. Oh, yeah. We ain't read. Those are like 12 and under.
Yeah, I was like, how am I going to read that? So those are my children. They're Generation Alpha. Our children are Alphas. Woo-hoo. But they're more aware. And I was having a conversation one time, and I realized when we were talking about like traumas, like generational traumas or going to therapy or things like that, or when they were contemplating or saying that, oh, this new generation is soft, right? Soft. And I have been one of them. I've been one of them at times. Like, I ain't kind of soft, man. But that's realized that's just my trauma speaking that I'm still working through. That's my, you're not allowed to cry. Mm-hmm. You're not allowed to like make a sound. Like you're supposed to take the whipping and just be right there. Mm-hmm. And you're supposed to get a spanking. You're not supposed to talk to your parents unless they talk to you. Like that type of thing. Like you're fine. You don't need help. And that's my issues. But then I started to understand through this conversation that they're just more aware that that's not okay. Mm-hmm. And it's like, no, that's not okay. I don't need to do what you're
doing.
We
don't have to do this.
No, I should go talk to somebody. And that is such a mind, it was a mind shift change for me that I'm still working on, like being really, really good at. But I think that's what makes these younger generations so much better.
Yeah.
Is that they're aware that I don't have to continue to perpetuate that. I don't have to wait till I'm 40 to figure out that this was a negative thing. Like I'm gonna figure it out right now. And I do want a safe space right now. You know, they always want to make fun of that word, that term, oh, safe space. Mm-hmm. I do want a safe space. I want to be able to say I'm LGBTQ plus whatever and not feel like you're gonna kill me or beat me up for it or drag me down the street. Like I wanna be able to say, you know what, I'm a man and I wanna cry and this does hurt me and it hurts my feelings and not be able to be made fun of that I'm not a real man. But they understand that now. Which is why they're more powerful than we were at that age because they already know and they don't have to hide it in and they can create these steps.
And so, those are the truly courageous people because, and we know that there's in certain communities, that we're still not allowing youth or people in general to be that free. And so those kids that are in these spaces where it is still not okay that these old norms, and I talk a lot about choice because it's a choice. We choose to be this sheltered, to be this closed off, to be this afraid. Those kids that are making the choice not to are the most courageous people in our entire society. And if we can elevate that courage and that bravery and let it shine and let it thrive, look out.
The sky's the limit. Because then, like we talked about, you mentioned Little Nas X, just being, right? And then we can see what they're going to create in the future, whatever it's going to be, whether it's music, whether it's working in nonprofit, whether it's going into government, whatever it is, it's going to be awesome because they're going to feel like themselves, mm-hmm. and they don't have to wear a shell like you and I did. And they don't have to let it crack 20, 30 years mm-hmm. later. They're already moving and grooving with who they are. They're like, you know, was it the Oscar Wilde quote, you know, be you because everyone else is taken.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there, one another guest, Rhea Wong, she told me, she shared that quote with me. And I was like, yeah, that is great. But now kids are learning that now, the mm-hmm. essence of that now. Like, I can only be me. I can't be anybody else but me. And you just kind of have to live with it and navigate around me. And that's like such a cool turnaround for our yeah. youth. And working in spaces like you and I do, and working in nonprofits and working directly in the community to be able to like just protect those embers of that flame, you know, just keep blowing on it and like, okay, let's get it to a roaring fire. And it's lookout.
And listen, now I'm not gonna say that my 13-year-old nephew don't work my nerves with all of this freedom and liberation that he has, because he's brilliant,
yes,
and smart and gets on, gets you. So that don't mean that it won't be hard to deal with these youth.
They're not like perfect.
But yeah, it's like it's in those moments that it's hard that we're being stretched. We're not being broken. And so we need to lean into those spaces where we allow that stretch to happen, because the same with the muscle. I can't remember who, like, I was listening to some speaker and they said, the way that muscle, and they're like, no, if you're a doctor and I'm wrong, you just tell me later. That when you stretch a muscle, then it's able to rebuild and that's how you get stronger. So we're just stretching ourselves and knowing that in that stretch and in that tension, that's how we grow and how we get stronger. So we can't be afraid of those, because yeah, when in allowing this, when we're sharing power with youth, with adults, with other populations, you are going to be stretched. You're going to make mistakes. Failure is growth and learning. And if you haven't failed, then you don't really learn. So it's not always going to be easy. It's not always going to be fun. It's going to be messy. It's going to suck sometimes. And so I think we have to also remember that, like, in this exploration and in allowing for this, it's not always going to be good. Mm-hmm. And you got to keep moving through that as well.
And we can't direct them. We can't try to step in and stop it from being messy,
because mm-hmm.
that's the other part. We know it's going to be messy, or other people know it's going to be messy, and they want to save it from the mess. And we can't do that, because
mm-hmm.
that's when you're not being an authentic partner. That's when you're not being intentional, because you're trying to save me mm-hmm. or save this person versus share the power, like you said. And that's where we get issues within nonprofits. People want to save you from the
dirty. And then you stop. Oh, it got messy. It
doesn't
work.
It doesn't work. You know, they didn't want to really do it. And I was like, no, you got to help them through the muck.
Mm-hmm.
You got to pull them, throw the rope. We got to pull through the mud. We're going to get really, really dirty. But when we come out the other side, it's mm-hmm. going to be great. You know, it's always dark in the tunnel. You just got to know that there's the light mm-hmm. and keep walking towards that light. So yeah, that's amazing. It really, the work that you're doing in Omaha, and it sounds like the work that you're trying to do nationwide, is inspiring, as it should be, because yeah. more people, I think, should think like that, or think like how you are, or approach it how you're approaching, especially if you're working in a space where you're trying to change communities, which in terms is changing people.
Mm-hmm.
And because whenever people, I think sometimes the blanket statement is always community,
mm-hmm.
but when you really drill down to it, it's the people that live in the community. And sometimes a community is just one household.
Mm-hmm.
And how are we changing that community? And I think if more people had your vision at the top, there would be less issues, I think, with nonprofits. And I also, there would be less of that weird stigma. Or I work for a nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the side I... Okay.
Yeah.
You just didn't want to pay taxes. You know, like you get less of that stigma because people would genuinely see the change that gets talked about on paper when you write for a grant. And that's where sometimes other people may get mixed up at. They're just constantly trying to write for funds or trying to write for a grant, and they want to do so many good things. But are you really thinking through this? How, if it was just one family you had to change,
mm-hmm.
how do you put a vision in play to change that family?
Mm-hmm.
And I think your vision that you've outlined here and what Inclusive Communities is doing, I think you're trying to change every individual community in Omaha, and it is beautiful to hear. And I'm so glad that you were able to have experiences that showed you you were the right person to do that. And that it's just been amazing having you here and being able to listen to you. It's like a free TED Talk for me. So this is amazing. And I want to ask a couple questions before we kind of wrap things up. So this is more of the scripted part of the show, because I really like the guests to talk, because it's not about me. It's about you and sharing your story so other people can hear it. I want to ask this is, if you had a time machine, right, and you could go back in time to any time in your life and you could talk to any age Cammie you want, what age would you go back to and what would you say?
Oh, gosh. I feel like maybe I'm going to go back to 4 or 5 year old Cammie, because when I think about some of the things that I was doing as little baby Cammie, that was probably the truest form of who I was. Because it was before I really had media telling me or things like that. So if I could hit little baby Cammie, who was in her truest form, who remembers seeing my mom pay my babysitter and me asking her, why are you paying her? And she said, oh, because she watches you. And I was like, she doesn't watch us. Her brother does. And my mom's like, take this popsicle and please go outside. And then the next day, that woman was no longer our babysitter and her brother was. I saw something that I was like, this doesn't make sense. I questioned it. I learned, got a little more information, and then did something about it, spoke my truth. And then change happened. And that let her know, like, stay on this path, baby girl. Like, you, like, who you are, this outspoken, there's nothing wrong with that. Because it would have probably saved me years of being extremely shy and introverted and quiet and not speaking out and then having regret. And so it wasn't until college when I decided, all right, I'm not going to, because then that regret turned into resentment. And then it turned into anger. And then it turned into silence. To just not feel those things. So once I moved to in life where I said, I'm no longer going to regret anything. I don't want to ever have regrets. So I'm going to do the things, get the things, celebrate the things. And then also I'm not going to live my life mad or angry with hate, so that no longer do I hate anyone. I won't live my life that way. And I won't hold grudges anymore. In the freedom that gave. If I could have talked to little 4-year-old Cammie to help her better understand, live without regret, live without hate, and live without kind of that forcefulness to just stay silent, I would have been doing this decades ago.
Are you a movie watcher?
I am.
Okay. So one of my favorite movies is The Incredibles.
Mm-hmm.
And what you talked about with going back to your 4-year-old, your most true self. And some people I've talked, because I love movies, right? And they didn't understand that. That's, if you've ever seen The Incredibles?
Mm-hmm, the little baby.
That's Jack-Jack. The reason why people understand, why is Jack-Jack so many? Jack-Jack has so many powers because he's a baby. And he can literally do anything. So when you're little like that, so anybody who's younger listening to this, or you have younger kids, when they're little, you can do anything. And that's why Jack-Jack has 90,000 powers, and you don't know which power it's going to be. and he just has to grow into what he wants to be at. And I think if we can just cultivate all the little powers we have, we'll figure it out. Like you said, it'll be dirty, but we'll figure it out and we'll find our superpower. And even though we may be ordinary and outside, we're going to be able to do extraordinary things. So yes, go back and tell your inner Jack that you can be anything and stay who you are, because that effectively makes us stronger now when we get older. Awesome. I had to get a Jack reference in there. I love that. And then my next question is, and this is more like the shameless plug question, you know, if anybody wanted to work or partner or just find out more, because inclusive communities is, you're huge. You guys are big time. But there's still people that don't know. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I always find that interesting. There's people that just don't know. So what do you do again?
Yeah.
So what do you do? Oh, you do this? Oh, you do this? You do that? And then so how can people learn more? People who are in Omaha, not in Omaha, mm-hmm. or around Nebraska or nationwide, how can they learn more about inclusive communities? How can they help or volunteer time? How would they do that? Or how would they just be able to, I don't know if they can get in touch with you, but get in touch mm-hmm. with you to work within their community more with you.
To connect with us, absolutely. Yeah. So Inclusive Communities, our website is www.inclusive.com/, you have to have the hyphen. I don't know when we got that URL, that's just the thing, hyphen communities, and it's communities plural .org. We got our website updated a year ago, and so now it's actually user-friendly in every shape or form. So our primary volunteer opportunities for youth is through our Inclusive City Camp. And so it's generally youth come through there, but we, even if you haven't had a chance to come to the camp, but you're bringing that mindset of support and empathy and healthy relationships and dialogue as a form of resistance, that's an opportunity. And then the other way for virtual, because our offices are based in Omaha, but we serve the entire state of Nebraska, Western Iowa, and we work on the Rosebud with the school, Todd County Schools, and the Rosebud Reservation in South Dakota. We're also starting to dabble in Kansas City as well with our business and adult programming. We have our Table Talk series, which is always hybrid. So we always need volunteers to help guide table conversations and those small group facilitation. And those are chances to talk about topics from the intersection of faith and sexuality to Native American experiences to Asian American and Pacific Islander experiences of like breaking through what they refer to as the bamboo ceiling. That was our conversation we just had earlier this week, earlier in April. And there's that. There's donations are always valuable, but we don't actually, the philosophies that we embed into organizations is the same way that we interact in the community. So we truly believe that we should not be trying to have people practice things that we aren't also practicing. So we practice what we preach. So our internal culture is one in which we support professional development. Every single staff member has a coach, a socio-emotional coach, because this is heavy labor, this is heavy work. And we do that, integrate that in our workshops with our programming for adults. So both if you're a nonprofit or a corporation, we offer our fee for service, and that's part of how we're able to have the autonomy to do the work. We actually are our own biggest donor. Our largest contributions come from our fee-for-service, and that's to give us the autonomy to do this work without having to beg funders to fund us. So we want to shift that dynamic of donors. So if you're even a philanthropy agent that wants to get more into being an accomplice to nonprofits, we're happy to come and do some coaching and support and education and workshops with your folks. If you are an adult that wants to just do some leadership development, we actually have a leadership program called Lead Diversity that is a 9-month cohort based where you get to lean into following our rubric of affirm, confront, and transform. We call it our ACT. So all of our services are action services, action training, action series. And it's on that first, you've got to start with self and affirmation and understanding of identities and difference. Then the confront, which is working within your own sphere of influence and power to share in transfer that knowledge and then transform. We're working on a more institutional level to have that transformation through whatever way that looks like, policy or service.
That is a lot. No, I always say that is a lot, but not in a bad way. That is a lot in, it's beautiful that it's a lot. And it's beautiful in the way that you have that internal culture, and it's beautiful the way that you're showing a different way for people to get in contact and connect with you. Because it's not about, okay, we're good. We don't need the money. We'll take it. But come here and do the work. Be boots on the ground. Really work and live and affirm into change. And so it's amazing. I wish we could just keep going on for 2 hours because I would talk about everything. But I want to close out the show, and I want to say thank you so much for taking your time to be here. Thank you for sharing your story, sharing your brilliance with us, because it has been. I have found every word you've said just hanging on it. So thank you so much for being here. And you are definitely a wild one. You're definitely someone who is working in your love daily, and you are sharing your passion. You've turned it into a profession, and you're sharing it to other people in the community. So thank you, Cammie, for being on the show. And thank you to all the listeners out there. I appreciate you. And as always, peace.